Thanks, James, and morning, everyone. Good to see you all. Welcome. As I was thinking about today's service, it seems as though we've suddenly entered the period of Lent, and I was expecting to look out on and see you all with hungry faces and looking a bit desperate because you're giving up chocolate, but Mary reminded me that my daughter's become a vegan for Lent, so I don't know how she'll cope with that one. But it's actually only 2 months ago. It's 2 months today since it was Christmas Day, and it was tucking into our worrying about the turkey. Is it going to be cooked right this year? And are the roast spuds going to be done right? And all this. So went from one scenario to another in a pretty short space of time. And I'm hoping this works. But Christmas, we had our grandchildren for a few days before Christmas, and I thought to keep them entertained. I don't know if any of you go to Malbix, the Malbix Garden Nursery, but they have a real good Christmas display on. And I splashed out on this little thing for the kids. Yeah, call me generous. That's why I became the treasurer. But it's a little bottle with a Christmas tree and snow inside. But the thing with it, it's a little bit special because when you pull the plug out of the top, you can pre-record a message. And so I pulled the plug out and I've recorded the message, Happy Christmas, Erica, Happy Christmas, Ollie. And it kept him good for all of 2 minutes. And they went home and I thought, what shall I do with it now? So I thought, oh no, I'll record a message for the dog. You know, she's the... So I hope this works. So here's my message for the dog.
Behave yourself, will ya?
Now, did you get that? Behave. I thought, I hope you like that, Deloise. You know, you could play that to your mum, actually. but as you'd expect, the dog looked at it and cocked her head and walked off. And she don't behave herself. I've got to be kind. It's her birthday today. She's 3 years old. She's 21 in doggy years. So, but. I was thinking about, and it sort of leads on to this, the message today. If Jesus had a message for us, would we listen to it? And there's a message that Jesus keeps saying throughout the passage that James kindly read. And I just thought I'd go through. I don't know if you spotted it, but it says something to the disciples, and he says it not once or twice, but he says it several times. And the first time he says it is in at the very beginning of the reading, which is Mark 7, verse 24, which is where we're looking at the faith of the Syrophoenician woman. He entered a house and didn't want anyone to know it, yet he couldn't keep his presence secret. So he wanted to keep it quiet. Then again in verse 36, the healing of the deaf and mute man, Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. And yet again, in chapter 8, verse 26, which is where we read that the miracle of the healing of a blind man at Bethsaida, Jesus sent the blind man home saying, don't go into the village. And there's a little footnote there in my Bible that says, some manuscripts say, don't go and tell anyone in the village. And then finally, where we read about Peter's confession of Christ, in verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. And that continues a couple of times into chapter 9 as well. I'm not going to read them all, but you kind of get the picture. Jesus had a message for the disciples at that point in time, not to tell people who he was, not to tell people what was going on. And did the disciples listen to him? It sounds like they didn't, because in fact it says that they didn't. So I think, well, I've got to watch it. If Jesus speaks to me, will I listen? And if I do listen, will I do what he says? I do wonder about this, and I've wondered about this for over the years. I've never really looked at it in any depth, I suppose, but it's sort of occurred to me, why does he want to keep it? Why does Jesus want to keep this a secret? Because there's such miraculous things. You'd think that people would want to shout it from the rooftops. And reading in the one commentary source that I was looking at, it's apparently there's a name for it. It's called the Messianic Secret. So the Messianic Secret is the official description. And there are a number of reasons that have been put forward. And I think, well, we have to be careful when we put man's thoughts in addition to the Bible, because obviously they're man's thoughts and it's easy to get it wrong. But there are a number of kind of credible thoughts that go to this. One is that it reflects that Jesus is concerned to complete his mission without interruption. So if people did keep talking and doing what he didn't want them to do, his mission would be interrupted. Another reason was that he wanted the disciples to really understand who he was and come to their conclusions the right way. In other words, he wasn't just a magician. He wasn't a conjurer, if you like. He wasn't someone who came along and did magic tricks. Another reason was maybe a premature recognition would demand he became a political messiah. And I suppose this is more relevant to the day, that people would think, oh, Jesus is here to come and lead the Jews out of the captivity of the Romans. And that wasn't really what Jesus was about. But so you've got all these sort of ideas that have been put forward, but which are credible reasons, but ultimately we don't know for sure. But if there's uncertainty about why Jesus asked his disciples not to tell people who he was, then we'll find that there is clarity as to who Peter is when he makes his declaration at the end of the reading. And it's a very important reading, this, because it's kind of it's kind of the watershed of Mark's gospel. It's sort of leading up to this pinnacle before Jesus takes us on. And we'll come on to that in a few minutes. But the passage that we've read covers a number of miracles which Jesus performed. And the significant thing about all these miracles is that they're all performed primarily with Gentile or non-Jewish people. So first of all, we've got the faith of the Syro-Phoenician woman, which we read is in the vicinity of Tyre. So she's a Gentile. And she asked Jesus to heal her daughter, who was possessed by a spirit. Then we've got the healing of the deaf and mute man in Decapolis. And he's also a Gentile. And then we come on to the feeding of the 4,000, and that's again in Decapolis. And that's a Gentile region, so presumably most, if not all, of the people there are Gentiles. And we've got and it's a kind of important chapter, this. We saw a week or so ago when Jesus fed the 5,000 in chapter 6. When Jesus fed the 5,000, those people were primarily Jewish. And as James pointed out, then in that instance, there were baskets of leftovers. Chapter 6 tells us for the Jewish one, the 5,000, there were 12 baskets of leftovers, and people have compared this to the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's a kind of completeness, if you like, of the tribes of Israel. Here we've got the reading of the fourth at the feeding of the 4,000, where we read that there are seven baskets of leftovers, and seven is a special number in the Bible because it represents a kind of completeness. And if you remember, when someone asks Jesus, "Should I forgive my brother seven times?" and he says, "No, you should forgive him 70 times seven." It's a kind of full or a complete number. So perhaps those numbers are significant, and the miracles are significant, because it's saying that it's a completeness. So it's a completeness for the Jews and it's a completeness for the Gentiles. No one is left out. Then the final miracle is the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida, which is by the Sea of Galilee. And this is a kind of special miracle in a way, because the Old Testament doesn't record any instances where a blind man is healed of his blindness. So the healing of a blind man was special, and it was special that Jesus healed him. So previous miracles focused on the Jews, these focused on the Gentiles. What was the effect on the disciples? Well, we'll look at that shortly. What did the Jewish leaders think? Well, we read in chapter 8, verse 11, the Pharisees came to Jesus and began to question him, asking for a sign from heaven. So we read in previous chapters that we've looked at over previous weeks that they took offence. And now they began to test him, saying, "Do what we say, prove it," and all the rest. So, and their rules were being broken, and they didn't like it. But Jesus revealed himself to his followers gradually. And as we heard last week, Jesus performed several miracles. Jesus walked on water. Jesus healed a demon-possessed man. He restored a girl to life. And all these are, as James pointed out, building blocks. And they're building blocks really all to demonstrate the authority of Jesus. And it's all the authority of Jesus, the authority over illness, the authority over nature, basically the authority over everything. And it kind of reminds me of a saying that we used to say, that Jesus is either the Lord of all or he's not the Lord at all. Jesus didn't come to do a few healings and that would be it. Jesus demonstrated that he was the Lord in all situations. And I think as Christians we can draw comfort from that, that in every situation that we come across, we all come across different situations in our lives, that no matter what, Jesus is Lord, if we trust him. And we kind of, and against all this, against all these miracles, against all the miracles again with the Jews, against all the miracles with the Gentiles and the teaching and that, then the demonstration of his authority, we come to what really is the centrepiece of Mark, which is Peter's confession of Christ. So, and in verse 27, we read, Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" And have we got the picture there? Oh, please. Thank you. So, the question we need to consider is the question that Jesus asks his disciples. And the question he asks them first of all is, who do people say that I am? He doesn't say, who do you say that I am? He says, who do people say that I am? And we can provide a response to Jesus' question. They replied, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. And that leads on to Jesus saying, well, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And we can provide a response to that. We can answer that question. But when we answer it, what difference does it make to us? What difference does it make to me? Peter says, you're the Christ. And when he says, you're the Christ, that means you're the Messiah, you're the anointed one. And that's kind of special, because it's a special moment in the gospel, because it's the first time that the word Messiah is mentioned. Then after that, it's mentioned 5 times in the remainder of the gospel. So it's a defining moment in this story. And it's a special moment, and it's told in a special place. Verse 27 says that they were in the villages around Caesarea Philippi. I've got this, I've kind of cribbed this picture from David Pawson, who used to be a Baptist minister down in Guildford, Surrey. It's not to be taken too literally, but it shows the point. And so Caesarea Philippi is in the very northern parts. I believe it's in Syria. So Jesus' travels took him from the northern parts of Israel. And if you recall, in the beginning of Mark's gospel begins with Jesus and John the Baptist baptizing around the River Jordan, and so a lot of the stuff that's going on is around around the River Jordan, and I've shown that there, and that's Lake Galilee, which is sort of towards the bottom there. If you carry on southwards, then the Jordan River goes down into the Dead Sea, which is one of the lowest, the lowest region in Israel. So it's not to be taken too literally, because the River Jordan flows in more of a north-south direction rather than a kind of east-west. It's just to show the point. So Jesus goes to Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is on the way to it's at the foothills of Mount Hermon, and the reference books tells us that Mount Hermon is actually the source of the River Jordan, and I've shown it there with a bit of snow on the top, and it's the melting snow that flows down into the Jordan, and that's really the source of the Jordan, and it's about 30 to 40 feet wide. And it used to be a place of superstition, because the water flowed from the top and it filtered down a crack in the mountain, and so it wasn't easily visible, so it was just it sort of magically appeared through a hole beneath the surface of the river. And because of this kind of the superstition that went around it, there'd be a statue which people put up there. There's a Greek god called Pan, and there's a statue there, and Pan was a person who was supposed to have appeared as a mortal man. And there's also a statue of Caesar there, who's Caesar was a man, an emperor who was called a god, and he was put. This statue was put there by Philip, who was one of Herod the Great's sons. So if you think of Philip and Caesar, that's where the name Caesarea Philippi come from. So we've got this place that Jesus took the disciples to, which is a place of superstition. It's a place where idols have been put up into little crevices. And What a location for Jesus to ask the disciples, "Who do folks say that I am?" And so amongst all this kind of idolatry, Jesus is saying, who do you say that I am? And I find it kind of tragic in a way that the only person that comes up with the right answer, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, one of the other Gospels says, people say he was Jeremiah, one of the prophets. they were the answers of the day. They were what people were thinking about Jesus. They'd seen all these miracles. They'd seen all these fantastic events take place. And they were equating him with John the Baptist, Moses perhaps, Elijah. And it's only Peter that says, "You're the Christ, you're the Son of the living God." So up to this point, Jesus doesn't mention his death, so it's a watershed moment. Straight after this, and we'll come on to this next week, Jesus predicts his death. So it's an interesting journey that we see. And if you look at the route from the time that Jesus took to get to Mount Hermon or to Caesarea Philippi, it was something in the order of 2.5 years. And then we see another 6 months, which takes us through the remainder of the gospel. And that takes us through to Golgotha and the resurrection. And and then we've got the 1 week, roughly, where we have the death of Jesus and his resurrection. So that's okay. So and the two circles at the end of the resurrection are supposed to be the stone and the yeah, put it onto silence. That's all right. So the conclusion then is that, well, we're not at Caesarea Philippi surrounded by false idols, but we're in a world where other idols have taken the place of Caesar and the Greek god Pan. And we've got idols such as possessions, I don't know, wealth, careers. And we talk about we're in a post-Christian world, which to a lot of people says, well, basically I've replaced God, because if there's no God, I'm the most important person that matters. And an idol is really something that obstructs or takes away our relationship with God. But amongst all the idols that the world throws at us, the question is still the same, which is, who do you say that I am? Jesus asked the disciples that, but I believe that he asks every one of us that. And the message today isn't, don't tell people who I am. Don't keep it quiet. The message today is different. So the message today is that Jesus came as the Messiah for the Jew and Gentile. So it's a message of good news for everyone. And the message that we have today, one of the messages that Jesus gives us today, can be found right at the end of Mark, where Jesus says, "Go into the world and preach the good news to all creation." So it's a message that followers that we read about in Acts took on board, and it's a good book to follow on from. So it's the message for us, and people talk about Acts as the unfinished book. So the message is, go out and preach the word. And I thought, well, as I'm reading this, I thought, oh, it's an easy thing for Jesus to say, keep it quiet, because we're all good at that. But then Jesus says, But then after the resurrection and that, our job is to go out and tell the world. And I think, well, if we really, really believe that God is, that Jesus is Lord and Jesus is God's Son and he rose from the death wall, if we really believe that, it shouldn't be such a difficult thing to take that message out. So we have to question, what's our response? Do we put the lid back on the bottle quick, or do we take it on board and do what Jesus asks? And we're kind of halfway through Mark's gospel, and we're halfway through, and Mark has taken us to the point where the answer to who Jesus is given. So we know that Jesus has the authority. We're at Mount Hermon with him. And the rest of the gospel, the good news is that we're going to take us, the rest of the gospel is going to take us through the final 6 months to tell us how Jesus will save us, whether we're a Jew or whether we're a Gentile, which is, I guess, what most of us are. We're non-Jewish. So the question to take with us is, if Jesus is the Messiah, how is he going to save not only Israel, but also the Gentiles from the sin that is inside them and that defiles them and defiles us? And you'll have to come again next week to find out the answer. So look forward to what James has got to say to us. So it's a message of deliverance from sin. And it's a message of just restoring our relationship with God for every one of us. Amen.